Kentucky Congressman Thomas Massey has cleared a major hurdle to getting the Epstein files released. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our Friday news review, the latest on the discharge petition. Plus, reporter Joe Sonka just got back from a press conference outside Senator Mitch McConnell's office, and Kentucky farmers aren't happy with him. Then we have election results for culture war candidates in school board races across Ohio and Cincinnati Mayor Aftab Pureval's State of the City address. Joining me now to get the news review started are Kentucky Public Radio reporter Joe Sonka and Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Haley B. Miller. Thank you both for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to both of you. Joe, on Wednesday, U.S. Representative Thomas Massey made significant progress on this push for the release of the Epstein files. Tell us about that. What happened?
Yeah, this has been a long time coming from him. He first filed a discharge petition in July, hoping to force a vote on his resolution to get the U.S. Justice Department to release all of their documents, all of their files related to Jeffrey Epstein, of course, the notorious pedophile who died in his jail cell a few years ago. So he'd been waiting to get the last signature he needed. And there was a special election about a month and a half ago where a Democratic Congresswoman in Arizona was elected, but she wasn't sworn in because of the government shutdown, and Speaker Mike Johnson did not let her be sworn in until the government shutdown ended. The government shutdown ended this week, and she was sworn in, so he got his 218th signature. So that can go forward. It has to be voted on by early December. But Speaker Johnson indicated this week that he's going to allow it to come up for a vote next week. So okay. while there were only four Republicans who voted added on to the petition, including Thomas Massey, all Democrats did. There is word that a lot more Republicans are going to vote for the resolution now that it's going to get to the floor.
Gotcha. So this discharge petition is going to force that vote. Haley, survivors have backed this effort, haven't they?
Yeah, I think there's been a call from survivors for more transparency for the federal government to release the information it has. And, you know, certainly a lot of public officials feel that way as well. And it's been interesting to see how the conversation has changed during the Trump administration, because you had people like Vice President J.D. Vance, Vivek Ramaswamy, who's running for Ohio governor, calling on the federal government to release this information. I think the thinking at the time was, you know, there may be powerful Democrats who could be implicated in this. But of course, now that Trump is in office, we've seen some of those folks dial back that rhetoric.
Joe, you mentioned that obviously Congressman Massey voted for this, or he signed this discharge petition, that Democratic members of Congress signed it. Any idea where the rest of Kentucky's Republican members of Congress stand on this?
Well, none of them signed on to the discharge petition. It's interesting that Kentucky has a kind of a sizable influence in this, because Congressman James Comer actually chairs the House Oversight Committee, which has also been looking into Epstein. And they actually released 20,000 documents the same day that Massey got the final signature he needed on the discharge petition, and released tons of emails of Jeffrey Epstein with various people talking about various things, including President Donald Trump. So I'm sure that the lone Democrat in Kentucky's delegation, Moore McGarvey, is going to be in favor of this. But we'll have to see how other Republicans vote on this, because the most popular Republican in Kentucky is Donald Trump, and Donald Trump has been fiercely opposed to this, and especially Thomas Massey. He doesn't like Massey because of this issue and several other issues, and that he's even recruited a GOP challenger to run against him next year because he's tired of – because Massey's one of those few Republicans that really does stray from Trump on several issues, that where he's lined up ideologically, he's not in support of him.
Well, Joe, how has Congressman Massey responded to the president on those criticisms and you know, this lining up of a primary opponent?
Well, he was just on CNN the night that the government shutdown ended and he got all the signatures he needed for the discharge petition. He was asked, like, well, why is Trump fighting you so hard on this? And he said, and these are his words, he said, you know, I vote with Republicans and the president 91% of the time, but when they're protecting pedophiles, I can't go along with that. So he is very unapologetic about moving forward this for this. And you mentioned the survivors. He held a press conference with a lot of survivors of Jeffrey Epstein this summer in D.C., I believe in September. So this is something he hasn't shied away with, just like Massey hasn't shied away with, you know, criticizing the big, beautiful bill for too much spending and creating too much debt, like he's criticized Trump for the strikes on Iran earlier this year. So he's definitely someone who sticks by his guns. And Trump is, you know, he's definitely targeted him for defying him, recruiting a challenger. There's been a Trump-aligned PAC that's been spending, I think, $2 million since the summer on attack ads against him. So it's an interesting battle between Trump and a Republican congressman when most of Congress, in terms of Republican delegation, has been in lockstep with whatever he wants.
Yeah. Haley, do you have a sense for Ohio's congressional delegation, whether, and I guess I'm thinking more specifically about the Republican members of Congress from Ohio? It doesn't sound like they signed the discharge petition, but have they spoken out much on what they think about whether these Epstein files should be released?
I'm aware of at least one Republican, Congressman Warren Davidson, who told CNN this week that he would vote yes on the floor, you know, if the discharge petition is successful. He did not sign it, but it sounds like he will be a yes vote next week. I'd be surprised if many other Ohio Republicans will get behind it. This is a state that is very much in lockstep with President Donald Trump, at least in terms of the Republican Party. And I'm not expecting too many surprises next week, but I guess we'll see when the time comes.
Yeah. Well, and if this does come to the floor of the House next week and there's a vote and this is passed, it would have to go to the Senate. Haley, have you heard much about what kind of support this has there in terms of release of the Epstein files?
I think that is a big question mark, and that's something that's been talked about this week. Even if the vote is successful in the House, that's just the first step of many. And I think you will see resistance to this in the Senate, certainly among a lot of Republicans. There are fewer people in the Senate. And so I think within each caucus, Republicans and Democrats, you know, there's some range ideologically, of course, but it's not like the House where you just really have a lot of different people with a lot of different perspectives. I think the Senate Republican caucus is a little bit more unified, kind of in lockstep with each other than perhaps House Republicans.
Hmm. And of course, even if it passes the Senate, the president has to sign it. So that you would be dealing with a veto override, most likely, if it does get to the president's desk.
Right. So, Joe, are you going to be watching for basically veto-proof majorities if and when these votes happen?
Yeah, definitely. And of course, all of the Republican members, when they're deciding how to vote, they're going to have to look at Thomas Massey and say, well, do I want President Trump coming after me and trying to get a primary challenger? Because I don't believe Republicans have overrid any vetoes of Trump. So that would definitely be a unique situation.
Hmm. Well, Joe, Haley just mentioned that the Republicans are usually pretty united in the Senate, but that was not the case on the floor of the U.S. Senate this week when there was a hemp showdown. Tell us about the debate there.
Yeah, that was a debate on the Senate floor between Senator Mitch McConnell and Senator Rand Paul, both Kentucky Republicans. They've been quite the odd couple over the past 16 years in Kentucky, where they're ideologically quite different, but they've been able to form kind of an alliance over that time and help each other out. But that's really been fraying over the past couple of years, and that was present with the provision that McConnell put into the continuing resolution to reopen the government that the hemp industry says will basically wipe out 95% of the industry nationwide. So McConnell's provision, which he's been trying to put in since this summer in the different spending bills, this was put in the last second, and it basically puts a cap of 0.4 milligrams of THC in any container sold of a hemp-derived product, whether that be CBD, which is like the non-psychoactive ingredient of cannabis and hemp that deals with helping with pain or sleep and anxiety, and also products that have the THC, the psychoactive component of hemp. And that was all hemp was first legalized and really took off because of Mitch McConnell back in 2018, when he put language in the farm bill to legalize hemp, which is like marijuana, but it's a very, very low amount of THC in those plants. So that industry has really boomed since then. And now you have McConnell, who is upset with the bad actors in those industries, people who have made products synthetically that have very high concentrations of THC, that have labeling and marketing that is attractive to kids. So he's going after that. But the industry says, you're hitting all of these products that aren't intoxicating, that have very low amounts of THC. And this is the U.S. Hemp Roundtable, which is a national advocacy group, says this is a $28 billion industry with supports 300,000 jobs. And it's basically going to wipe out 95% of that because it's going to be hard to have any product that is going to be below that 0.4 milligrams per container limit in the bill.
Hmm. And I guess Rand Paul was on the side of the farmers and the industry, right?
Yeah, that's right. He's been fighting this language since the summer, and he filed a floor amendment, which would basically strip out all of the language that McConnell had put in at the last second. And he said that this is the most ignorant thing he's ever seen that's going after business. He said the same numbers that the hemp industry has put out, saying this is going to wipe out farmers. This is going to wipe out a product that people rely on for sleep and anxiety. And he's saying that this is the wrong thing to do. His floor amendment did get a vote. It was voted down. Partially, I think it's fair to say it's because people didn't want to be someone that got into the way of the CR and kept the government closed after a month and a half of the federal shutdown. So the one unique part about this provision is there's a 1 year. It's not going to be implemented for 1 year. So there's a moratorium, and a lot of people in the hemp industry are hoping that in this next year there's going to be legislation that kind of undoes that, sets like reasonable limits on THC for hemp products, so that the industry can survive and keep going.
Well, Haley, the concerns that Senator McConnell raised about marketing and packaging and children and all that, those sound a lot like what Governor Mike DeWine has been saying in Ohio, doesn't it?
Yeah, Ohio's been wrestling for a while now with how to deal with intoxicating hemp. As you noted, Governor DeWine is very opposed to it. He's been concerned that kids can too easily access it because of the loophole that used to exist in federal law. And this ban from Congress comes at kind of a tricky time for Ohio lawmakers. They're right now in the middle of negotiations for legislation to address the state's marijuana law, as well as hemp regulation. The Ohio House had passed something last month to basically create hemp dispensaries that would be similar to marijuana dispensaries in terms of how they're regulated. But with this federal ban on the books now, even if it doesn't take effect for 1 year, they're definitely rethinking how to approach hemp in this bill because, you know, as House Speaker Matt Huffman noted earlier this week, they don't want to create a whole regulatory system for hemp if it's going to be illegal at the federal level in a year.
Joe, didn't Kentucky pass a law to regulate these products already too?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Earlier this year in the legislative session, they passed a bill to put a 5 milligram limit on hemp beverages, which is kind of an industry that's exploded. So they work with the industry on setting regular, and there are other regulations dealing with hemp products in terms of the age limit for people to buy and how they can be sold. So that's one of the arguments they're making, that states are stepping up and making their own regulations that fit them. But here you have the federal government coming in and doing what they say amounts to basically a blanket ban on, you know, 95% of these products. The only products that everyone kind of agrees aren't going to be affected are like industrial hemp when dealing with like fibers and papers and grain and things like that. But that makes up a very small part of the overall hemp market that's taken off over the past decade.
Well, Joe, we mentioned that right before this show, you went to a press conference outside of Senator McConnell's office there in Louisville and talked to some farmers. What did you hear from them?
Yeah, Asa and Abram Phillips, they have a family farm in Owen County. They've had it for five generations, and they grow hemp, and they say that this would wipe them out. They just finished, they're at the tail end of their harvesting season right now for their hemp crop, and Asa was emotional at the mic because there were all these workers that they've had for 25, 30 years, and he was like, well, this is probably the last time I can ever employ them because there's no way we'll be able to have a hemp crop next year unless something changes. And he said that McConnell, like, isn't addressing people like him, who's not a bad actor, who's growing this crop that's helping people, helping their family, and now that livelihood is being taken away from them.
Haley, even beyond farmers, there are a lot of businesses that would feel the impact of this ban. Do you think they'll be lobbying for a change before this takes effect in a year?
Yeah, I think so. I talked with the co-owner of Urban Artifact in Cincinnati, which makes THC beverages, another industry that's very concerned about these changes. And, you know, they view, I think, this year gap as a bit of a saving grace. You know, they're hoping that perhaps they can convince Congress to change the rules, maybe make the ban less broad. So, you know, Urban Artifact has said they're going to continue business as usual for now in the hope that federal officials will agree to make some changes to this law. And I think, you know, very technically speaking, there are also some questions about whether, you know, Congress should be making policy changes and legislation that was supposed to just be for, you know, spending and appropriations and things like that. So I definitely don't think we've heard the last of this.
Well, I have been talking with Kentucky Public Radio reporter Joe Sonka and Cincinnati Enquirer reporter Haley B. Miller. Thank you both so much for your time today and for all this perspective and information.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, how culture war candidates fared in school board races across Ohio. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Across Ohio, candidates campaigning on culture war issues ran for seats on local school boards. So how did they do? Joining me now to explain is Signal Ohio reporter Jake Zuckerman. Welcome back, Jake.
Thank you for having me on again.
Well, we're grateful that you're here. So we've seen culture wars dominate lots of school board races across Ohio in recent years. What did you see with this year's elections?
Yeah, well, I took specifically a look at the incumbents. These are the people who got swept into office during the Biden years when there was this backlash to this perceived, I called it, I think, a liberal creep in the article, where there's this creeping liberalism in the form of liberal transgender policies for which bathrooms transgender students should use, this idea that teachers are teaching critical race theory or some of these, there's some other terms for it that get used, but just sort of this idea that public schools are indoctrinating kids with liberalism. And what I found is especially those incumbents, the one who got into office during the Biden years and governed on this sort of culture war platform, performed very poorly. They got swept out of office. This trend was true in a big liberal urban city like Akron. It was true in Allen County, which is in a little northwest of Columbus, very, very rural area. This is true in the upper Arlington, a wealthy Columbus suburb, in Grove City, a more modest Columbus suburb. So in just in all these different kinds of places and all these different political arenas, there was this pretty clear through line that voters, or at least the voters who came out on this off-year election day, which is always sort of tricky to tell how representative are they really did not seem to want to continue this sort of culture war animated school board governance.
Well, here in Greater Cincinnati, Forest Hills School District is kind of an example of this. In 2021, a slate of four conservative candidates won seats on the five-member school board. Now, after this year's election, every seat is held by a democratically endorsed candidate. So we've watched some of this play out here in our neck of the woods. Can you offer some more details about some of these candidates and races that you looked at specifically?
Sure. I'd be happy to. And I became aware of that Cincinnati race, unfortunately, after my article published. So that would have been a really nice one to include. But just to look at some examples, like in Akron Public Schools, the Carla Jackson was the head of the school board. She was the head of academics at Emmanuel Christian Academy, a private school. She, when she was on the board, voted against a policy requiring staff to use the preferred names and pronouns of other staff. She wrote some posts on Facebook. One of them involves something to the effect of like how transgender kids can become transformed when they come to realize they shouldn't be transgender, that sort of thing, just to spare the specifics. There was a good one. Oh, let's see. In Southwestern City School Board of Education, that's the Columbus area, where Chris Boso, who was the school board president, courted a lot of controversy by sort of affiliating himself with organizations that are pushing for, quote, English-only education, opposition to LGBTQ rights, and DEI. He called on the district to, quote, stand up to Title IX. So, you know, these sort of things, they tend to attract a lot of headlines, so they're not hard to find, and they come to be these sort of defining things about candidates or about actual school board members. And I think voters just made pretty clear that they're not interested. You know, school boards just maybe 10 years ago were these sort of sleepy places where involved parents and teachers might quibble about curricula. And now they're just these venues to fight about transgender policy and DEI. And I think voters have, or at least there's some evidence to suggest that voters have gotten a little tired of that.
What did you hear from progressives after these races when you talked to them about these results?
Yeah, I talked to Rachel Coyle, who works for a 501c4, so a nonprofit called Ohioans Against Extremism. And I talked to her because she pretty carefully cataloged a lot of these races. And, you know, mind you, this is an off-year election. I think after 2024, we're all very tired of elections. Many people don't know there are elections going on. Rachel's job is to make sure people do know and know who these people are. And we were barking up a similar tree. She tracked the races a little differently, but she saw enormous success. So when I was curious, how did the candidates do, not just the incumbents, and got a very mixed picture about 5 and 10 races. So about half of those candidates won, half lost. It's hard to draw conclusions from there. But when she got rid of the candidates who ran unopposed, say, Her figure was closer to 7 and 10. I don't think like any, even liberals, are keen to say, well, therefore culture wars are over. You know, I think there's awareness that this was a very, very low turnout election. Not a lot of people are tuning in. But what Rachel was saying is like, look, what we do know is that people know who their school board candidates are. And that's not nothing. I mean, how true was something like that 10 years ago when these were just these sleepy affairs? And also, Democrats are very engaged right now. They're very enraged right now. They're informed and they're showing up. And conversely, when I talked to Michael Gonadakis, who is a well-known lobbyist in Columbus, long affiliated with the anti-abortion movement, he gave a somewhat similar, you know, he really played up the off-year election bit, the low turnout, but he said there's no way to avoid it. Like, Democrats are totally hopped up right now. They're energized. And the social conservatives who elected these people in 2021, they stayed home.
There are so many factors that play into all this. Do you think there's a broader message to take away from these results?
I think that, you know, we'll have more conclusive data in 2022 when there's a lot broader of a base who's voting in the election. But
in 2026?
Oh, thank you. I've forgotten what year and almost a decade.
That's okay.
But I think that there's at least enough here for candidates to, so if you are a Democratic candidate, to say, maybe I don't need to just totally go swing to the right on some of these social issues. Maybe voters don't want the social issues. That could be a read. And I think there could be a read again. Like, I'm really trying to hedge the language here, but a Republican might look at this and say, maybe this isn't the surefire ace in the hole that it was 5 years ago. Maybe I need to think about a broader governance than just these very divisive, inflammatory issues that are often more of these hypothetical fights when there are so few or oftentimes no transgender students in some of these districts.
Well, I want to talk now about a different kind of fight. Tell us about this U.S. Supreme Court vote related to electric costs in Ohio.
Sure. So what happened is the U.S. Supreme Court declined to take a case. So that's not the same exactly as upholding an opinion, but they are letting stand an opinion from the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is a federal appeals court, which itself held up an order from federal energy regulators. But the big through line here is that two utilities in Ohio, including Duke Energy for your listeners in the Cincinnati area, and also First Energy up in the northern part of the state, have already been charging customers what is considered an incentive for the utilities joining the PJM, which is the 13-state grid. It's the electric grid that gets us, Pennsylvania, a bunch of other states, one of the biggest grids in the region. And states set energy policy. And for states that do not require utilities to join PJM, they offer these incentives. And these incentives are funded by ratepayers. And you need the approval of regulators like the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to charge these incentives customers. But the thinking being, we have this outcome we want. Maybe if we sweeten the pot a little for utilities, they'll just join PJM, which is all well and good. But in Ohio, we require utilities to join PJM. So it's not really discretionary, yet those two utilities I mentioned were charging, actively charging customers. This, quote, RTO adder was the legalese term for it. And two more utilities in Ohio, that's AES in the Dayton area and AEP in the Columbus area, said that they want to start charging this for customers in the future. So all this would have totaled up to be about an estimated $400 million by 2031 flowing from electric customers to these four utilities. And the federal regulators and the court stepped in and said, wait a minute. No, this is, there's no incentive here. These utilities are doing what they're required to do by law. So why on earth would we let them charge customers as if this were some discretionary good deed they were doing?
So this is obviously a complicated story that you know a whole lot about, so I'm very grateful that you're here. Any clue, you mentioned $400 million among all these different four utilities that would be flowing from customers to the utilities, I think you set up through 2031. What does this mean for the average customer's bill? Do we have any idea, or is that a big variable?
Sure. So the court ruling is going to send this back down to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, who's going to have to consider the issue of refunds, which are really only a live issue for Duke customers and AES Ohio customers, you know, the utilities that have been charging these fees. If there are refunds, I mean, the reality is on an individual customer basis, it's going to be a negligible amount. Usually these things, like for House Bill 6 to frame, you know, this was the biggest corruption issue in Ohio, et cetera, your listeners are probably familiar. That was about $1.50 on every electric bill. So I don't want to, you know, minimize the value of money. It means different things to different people, but we're not talking about huge sums. But in the aggregate, we are talking about a pretty significant wealth transfer from ordinary Ohioans to these investor-owned utilities. So I think it's more significant in the collective sense, but as far as is anyone going to get a big windfall if FERC goes in for refunds? Probably not.
Have you heard responses from these utility companies? I'm thinking of around here, Duke Energy, of course, but what are these utilities have to say about what the Supreme Court did?
No, the utilities were very hands-off when I reached out to them. They generally said things to the effect of, we respect the, you know, the court's ruling, the judge's rulings here. This goes back to the FERC, so it's still a live matter. We will do as we're instructed by the legal system. So nothing much of substance, but noticeably what they're not saying is, we're just going to get ahead of this and just give people their money back because this is wrong. So there's not really any sort of admission of, whoops, we shouldn't have charged this. And there's certainly no, we're just going to send you the, we don't need to be told to give this money back. We're just going to do it.
You mentioned before the this going back to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Talk about that. So what's next with this? Why does it have to go back to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission?
Well, namely, they're going to have to consider the issue of refunds. What the courts did is uphold what the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission originally said, which is get out of town. You are absolutely not going to charge these customers this money. So now that the courts have upheld that ruling, FERC is going to have to decide, well, are we going to make those two utilities I mentioned give the money back? So that's really the next big question for the FERC to answer. They're the most important regulators that nobody has ever heard of.
Yeah. Yeah, they were news to me when I was reading your story. So this FERC, you know, we've heard about so many regulatory organizations that have changed considerably or at least in some way with the change in administrations. Do we have any read on that with the FERC? Has it changed its outlook on these kinds of things with the Trump administration, or is it pretty much doing its thing no matter who the president is?
You know, you ask a great question, and I'm afraid I just don't have a good answer for you. I wish I knew more about the composition of the FERC and how it has changed, but I do not.
Okay. Any idea what the timing might be, how quickly the FERC could take this up and customers could find out if they're going to get refunds or not?
Specifically, no, I do not, but I can promise you it will be slow and much slower than it should be.
That's just government, I guess, huh?
That is government.
So what are you going to be watching for with this? Is there something you've got your eye on?
Yeah, I think the refund question. I mean, I think it's always an issue. And you know, there's always been this kind of culture of friendliness, or at least a perceived culture of friendliness from regulators to these utilities. And are they going to have the gumption, especially a utility like AES Ohio? It's in a little more financial stress than some of its peers. But to say, this ain't your money, give it back. Or are they going to stand down and say, well, you guys can't collect this in the future, but we're going to let it slide for now?
Okay. Well, I have been talking with Signal Ohio reporter Jake Zuckerman. Thanks so much for your time today, Jake. It is always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thanks for having me on. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you, too. Up next, Mayor Aftab Purewall's State of the City Address. And mark your calendars, we've got a gardening show coming up next Wednesday. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Cincinnati Mayor Aftab Purewall gave his fourth State of the City address Thursday evening, his first since re-election. Joining me to talk about the address is WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello. Welcome back, Becca.
Thanks, Lucy.
Becca, was Mayor Purewall's speech more about looking back at his first term or looking ahead to what's next?
Definitely, in terms of specifics, more about looking back on the last 4 years and the policies that he and the city council have put forward. Looking forward, he spoke in certainly more general terms. There wasn't a lot of breaking news in the speech in terms of like specific policies that will be pursued in this next term. Primarily looking back, and it was interesting because, you know, I think if anybody were to kind of say what are the key moments in Purewall's first 4 years in office as Cincinnati mayor, the most controversial things come to mind first. But I thought it was interesting how he really took those controversial moments like connected communities and the railroad sale and really cast those as policy wins for him and for his administration.
So what else did he say about his big accomplishments during his first term? I mean, you mentioned these controversial things. He and city council majority really championed some of these policies that angered a lot of residents.
Yeah, I think connected communities is the best example of that. I mean, this was legislation that Purewall and a couple of other council members sponsored. It was passed by the majority of council. It was just three members of council that did not end up voting in favor of it. And it really did cause a lot of controversy. I think what's interesting about that is one of the complaints about connected communities was this feeling that there wasn't enough community engagement. But interestingly, I think the fact that there was a lot of time to talk about it is what got it so controversial, because there was enough time for folks to be aware that it was happening and kind of weigh in. So there was a pretty long period of public meetings and things like that where folks could come and learn about connected communities and give their opinion on it. And as controversial as that was, and as much as it came up during the election just last week, It really was a goal of the mayor and his administration. Obviously, they didn't intend for it to be controversial in the way that it was, but it was a goal going in for many of these folks on when they were campaigning for election the first time, that they would reform zoning code, make it easier to build housing, especially multifamily housing, pointing out that the zoning code had not been updated in decades. There's a lot of, or it was a lot of kind of minutiae and a lot of difficulty to get through some of the red tape. And so a lot of it was trying to simplify that. But at the same time, you know, kind of modernize the zoning code. So again, as controversial as it was, Pierville, you know, really touted this as a major victory for the city and for making it easier to build housing going forward.
Public safety has been a big issue in Cincinnati lately.
Ultimately, nothing else we do matters unless Cincinnatians feel safe going about their lives. And while I'm incredibly proud of the progress we've made and the strategies that we've implemented to deliver on our core responsibility to our city, progress is not the same thing as victory, particularly not when we've witnessed the challenges we've had this summer and fall.
Did he address the issue of public safety or what's going on with Police Chief Thigi any more directly than statements like that?
Public safety in general, he did address a little bit more directly, but did not mention the police chief situation in any way. Of course, as listeners probably remember, Police Chief Teresa Thigi has been placed on administrative leave pending an investigation into the effectiveness of her leadership. Now, Pierville has said that that decision was City Manager Cheryl Long, so not his decision. He does support Long in that decision. But it is still interesting to not have that, you know, directly addressed in the speech. In terms of public safety, I think the other major difference in this speech compared to previous State of the City speeches is last year in particular, Pierville really touted some significant or measurable declines in crime rates since he took office. That's still true, that crime is down citywide from compared to when he took office. Of course, there's lots of other factors not necessarily tied directly to his leadership. But it is also true that the more short-term story is much more complicated, and there were pretty significant increases in violent crime and other crime downtown and over the Rhine and a few other pockets of the city. He didn't talk about crime rates at all specifically, but really focused on this idea that public safety is still a major priority for City Hall. Pierville has said many times it is the first, second, and third priority of his administration. And so while he didn't tout, you know, kind of the specifics of crime rates, he does say that public safety continues to be a major priority.
So we didn't talk about Police Chief Thigi directly, but her supporters sure made their presence known, right?
Yeah, unsurprising, I guess. But so you may have seen across the city these I Stand With Police Chief Thigi popping up around the city. I've seen them in Price Hill. I think, Lisa, you've seen them other yep. places as well. And a couple of weeks ago, we saw some of Thigi's family and friends show up to a city council meeting with those signs as well and speak in favor. They were there again last night outside the venue for the speech was Music Hall. So I saw, I think, five folks standing outside just, you know, kind of quietly protesting as people were streaming into the venue, getting ready to listen to the speech. But then a much larger version of that sign was also mounted on the back of a pickup truck that was circling the block right in front of Music Hall. So, again, a pretty quiet protest, but just, you know, kind of putting their message right there for folks who are getting ready to go listen to the mayor speak.
Okay. We've talked with you about the city's financial challenges, and the mayor addressed that, too.
It is a fundamental challenge of government, even when it is not a time of economic uncertainty, to find efficiency without sacrificing services. There will continue to be challenges ahead as costs rise faster than revenues. But we have been committed to maintaining our financial health while we continue to invest in our values and our residents.
Did the mayor offer specifics about how the city will achieve that balance of, you know, financial responsibility, but not cutting essential services or maintaining the services residents want?
Yeah, no real new information there, but just kind of looking at the administration and their priorities in general, I think it's interesting to contrast this with the very beginning of Pierville's term in office when he had a lot of this ARPA money, the American Rescue Plan Act, the federal stimulus that was available to fill budget deficits and also have funding to kind of really fund a lot of his early policy priorities. It was a really interesting time and a pretty unique situation for a mayor to come in with a lot of money to spend. Obviously, that federal stimulus has run out, and that's kind of the situation that the city is in now. It's worth noting that the most recent budget that council passed in June was structurally balanced. It did not have the benefit of the federal stimulus. So this administration and council has already passed one budget without the benefit of that. Looking ahead, there are projected budget deficits. There are a lot of different options for how to address that. One is to increase revenue, which could be done in two ways. One, increasing the income tax. And Pierrevold did not address this in the speech, but has answered the question previously that that's not off the table, that he would be willing to ask voters for an income tax increase. But another way to increase revenue, I think, is kind of the more explicit priority of this administration, which is without increasing the income tax, but just bringing in more people to pay that income tax. And so attracting new residents, the city population has been growing. But of course, the balance there is the city is not adding enough housing to keep up with the amount of population that's coming in. And so, eventually that scale is going to shift in the other direction. And so the priority of building as much housing as possible to keep up with the population growth and encourage more people to move to Cincinnati.
Well, when it comes to the city's financial needs, I know the mayor also has touted the railroad sale.
Because of the sale of the railroad and the $1.8 billion railway trust, we've been able to invest $60 million more over just the first 2 years of returns, more than doubling the previous lease payment and empowering us to make major improvements to our existing infrastructure.
He's also faced some major criticism over that, right?
This railroad sale was really one of the most... I have nightmares about it still. It was such an intense time. Now, this was interesting because the railroad sale, it was a decision of voters. It wasn't a decision of the mayor or city council. But while, city council members, for the most part, got behind the sale and told their constituents, yes, we approve of the sale. We want you to vote for it. A few kind of exceptions to that. The mayor really went all in and was a major face of the campaign to approve the sale. That had some controversial elements to it, but really it comes down to this is a plan that the railroad board of trustees previously managed the railroad and currently now manages the trust fund that has resulted from the sale. They'd been in talks about this potential sale for a very long time, had really looked at the numbers, done some projections, and predicted that it would benefit the city much more than the lease agreement. And so far, that's proven to be true. Those predictions have proven true. I'd say even despite some of the economic difficulties we've had in the stock market in particular. So again, Pierrevold really cast this as a major victory. This was something that the city really cast as a critical need. The city has this huge deferred maintenance problem. Any time that the city is facing financial difficulties over the last several decades, the easiest thing to cut is pay fewer lane miles on our streets. Let's put off replacing the AC unit in that rec center, et cetera, down the line. That's all been adding up year after year after year after year. And now it's just this huge hundreds of millions of dollar problem. The railroad sale does not solve that problem, but it shortens the gap in funding that the city has been facing. And so it's a step in that direction. And, Pierrevold really said this is a huge win for Cincinnati, and it's pretty significant that it passed. Again, this was a pretty narrow victory. It was a very, very small margin that voters approved it, but it was approved. And again, so far, all the predictions in terms of the revenue have proven true.
Well, another huge financial problem the city has been facing for years is fully funding the city pension. So what did he say about that?
Yeah, so I expected a little bit more detail on this, I'll be honest. the pension is a huge problem. It was brought up in the Futures Commission report. Excuse me. The Futures Commission had recommended a specific way to fund the pension. It's a very complicated process of regionalizing Greater Cincinnati Water Works, not privatizing, but regionalizing. And that would take a vote of the people and a lot of cooperation. It would take more than a decade probably to work out. So it seemed honestly not like a very realistic option. The mayor mentioned that the Futures Commission recommended focusing on the pension fund and that as a priority. But all he said really is that first he touted that the city a couple of years ago did amend the carryover budget process. So there's always money left over at the end of a fiscal year because you budget for less revenue than you expect just in case. And that means there's between $10 and $100 million, totally depending on the year, that's left over at the end of the fiscal year. Sometimes in the past, that's been kind of a thing for city council members to spend on their pet projects. In recent years, at least a portion of that has been earmarked for specific purposes, one of them being the pension fund. So this is extra money that goes into the pension fund separate from the withholdings that come from the employee paychecks and the percentage that the city contributes as a result or as a percentage of salary as well. It's not a huge amount of money, but Pureville said that has added $17 million more to that pension. That includes the current carryover, which nobody has seen yet. So he's touting numbers that we have not been able to verify yet. So just a note on that. But that's also not the long-term solution to the pension problem. So what he said about looking ahead is that the city is working with the pension board on a path forward, which is not a real plan. I think there is something behind the scenes that we just don't know yet. So we don't have any details on that yet, but basically touted the moves that have been made in recent years, but then also this kind of ambiguous, something's going to happen and we're working on it right now.
Foreshadowing.
Yes.
Okay. Well, in the minute and a half or so we have left, which isn't much time, what other new programs or initiatives did he highlight? And I will tell our listeners they can read a lot more about it in your story on WVXU.org.
Yeah, I'll highlight two that are interesting. Both are in the same neighborhood of Winton Hills. One is a grocery delivery pilot program. So this is a partnership with Kroger, where Kroger will waive the yearly delivery fee for their Boost membership for delivery. And the city will give up to 200 households $100 a month for 12 months for grocery spending. This is part of the city's financial freedom blueprint. That's an effort to reduce the racial wealth gap. That's going to get started in December. The other project that's pretty interesting is the city is going to build a new solar array in Winton Hills on the site of a former landfill. It's a brownfield site. It can't really be used for much else. The city had a nearly $10 million federal grant to fund that project, but lost that grant earlier this year because of the Trump administration's EPA cut that program entirely. It was a $7 billion program overall. But the city has decided to move forward with the project by pivoting to this other model. It's basically a public-private partnership. A developer will build, operate, and own the solar array. It's just like a lot like the way that the city built the large solar array out in Highland County that was built a few years ago. But in this case, the city is hoping to eventually purchase the solar array. But in the meantime, they'll purchase the energy that is produced by that solar array. It's enough to power 1,200 homes a year and eliminate 60,000 tons of carbon annually. So pretty interesting there. So those are two kind of the real new things that were announced in the speech last night.
Okay. Well, again, you can read much more about the Mayor's State of the City address on our website, WVXU.org. I've been talking with WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello. Thank you so much for your time today, Becca.
Thank you, Lucy.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Carlos Lopez Cornu. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening.